back. Welcome once again, Mike, and Oscar. Post-holiday. We got all our holiday weight on and
so many cookies.
Just going to leave it there.
cookies and more cookies.
I am your host, Mike. This is my co-host, also Mike.
Hello, I am also Mike.
He sure is. We haven't done that in a while.
No, that was our signature from the early days.
The early days, yeah. A couple weeks ago.
Monotone delivery introduction.
Today we're doing the Oscar Sprint Profile. Your laces are all tied up. You're ready to go. We've hit our starting marks and we've been off for a while. We're hitting the Oscar Sprint Profile for the movie of Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which is, I'm sure, a title that everyone says in full every time they refer to this movie.
Yeah, I thought for sure you were going to mix your metaphors there. I'm very impressed.
I
look at you.
Yeah, I had a couple days off and I practiced that one in my
well
mirror
rested.
A couple times.
Well rested. In your mirror, really.
Yeah,
oh, see, you've been wanting to get on YouTube.
The arsonist has red feet.
Save the children!
Anyway, like we did with The Disaster Artist, like we did in a pseudo-Oscar Sprint episode, more of a movie event with Star Wars, and you've heard with Dunkirk in the past, we're going to give you the deep dive into this Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which we will lovingly refer to only as Three Billboards, I'm sure, so we don't have to say the entire name.
3-B-O-E-M.
Yeah.
Mizzou. 3-B... Yeah. I screwed it up already.
Three Mizzou. So that's what we'll be doing today. We're giving you the deep dive, the production profile, box office notes, critical reception, production values, performances, spoiler section, non-spoiler section. We're going to give it
Mike
all to you.
Mike going through puberty.
I wish that wasn't intentional. That's what we're going to bring to you guys today. And so, like always, we're prepping you for getting you ready for Oscar night, Hollywood's biggest night. We're ending in on the New Year's, so the awards seasons are the big precursors, like we always talk about to kick off.
It's happening, yeah. Golden Globes in less than a week, week and a half.
Yeah, it's getting
less
serious.
Than 2 weeks.
Getting
yeah.
serious. So
down
let's
the pike.
Not waste any time. Let's get right into this. Three Billboards. Mike's going to start us off, as he always does, with a production profile.
Yeah, directed by Martin McDonough. He has said that he prefers writing films to plays, go figure, even though he is perhaps one of the most respected playwrights in the last 20 years across the pond there. He does say that he respects the whole history of films. And he does have a slight disrespect for theater. He's tempered that statement since, but kind of weird.
Can't imagine why.
From a great playwright.
All the Broadway actors ride his door with pitchforks and torches.
Fine with us, though. I mean, because we like our movies, our motion pictures.
He's a very brogy man.
He has a brogue, yes. He's very, very tall with a brogue. McDonough has... Where was I going with that?
Like a 1980s butt. Video dating profile. I enjoy long walks in Bruges.
McDonough has said throughout the promotion of the film at Toronto International Film Festival, this nugget, he had the image of the billboards in his mind when he kind of came up with this story. He had the mother character, Frances McDormand, her pain, but he didn't know where it was going to go from there. He didn't know where the story was going to go.
Just woke up in a fever dream one day like Keith Richards with the hook to Satisfaction.
Yeah. McDormand.
You didn't expect to hear that analysis today, did you?
I wonder if you have these anecdotes written down or
no,
just
I'm
comes,
just a
huh?
very sad person.
That was a good one. McDormand often praises the script as a literary piece of work. She just gushed over this script every interview she did.
Nice to have Frances McDormand back in our lives too, playing a big critical role.
Yeah, I mean, she is a Coen Brothers fave, obviously, because mm-hmm. she's a Coen Brothers wife. Not
figure.
Married to both of them. It's not polygamy, but she's married to one, I think, Joel.
They settled
anyway,
down
I'll say
in
that
Utah.
When I get to her bio.
I'm sorry for all our Utah listeners.
She's
thanks for coming along.
Anyway, McDormand always is the number one fan of this script. She says it's basically like its own document. It could exist merely as a screenplay, nothing else. I guess I have to read it then. But, I mean, it works as an authority, not just for the cast and crew, but all the way down the crew to the electricians and the grips. It's something that they can reference. Sam Rockwell has often said it was like opening a Christmas present when he first read this script. These are the things that actors say, I guess.
we wouldn't know.
So to get into the cast and crew now, I mean, Martin McDonough, written, directed, and produced by him. McDonough has written three major plays, produced for the West End Theatre District in London, kind of their Broadway, and then he's also had three more produced on Broadway. Christopher Walken was nominated for a Tony Award as the killer who's searching for his lost hand in a behanding in Spokane. A behanding in Spokane is the name of this
play. Is a behanding the actual, like a beheading? Like, is that the actual official title of a thing?
If he's looking for it, then he doesn't have it on his person. So, yeah, I think.
One would presume.
Well, maybe he's in just a nutcase and it's just right in front of him the whole time. And
it's just attached to his wrist like normal. He's wearing a glove.
I
want to
see this play like right now. Like, let's just stop the podcast and watch this play somewhere.
We're not going to give you a Christopher Walken impression either. Take that, listening audience.
Martin's short film. Six Shooter.
Up his ass!
Martin's short film Six Shooter won the Best Live Action Short Film Oscar in 2006, and his feature film debut came 2 years later within Bruges, one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, very cult-following type of movie there. He's got a couple cult-following classics.
Yeah, he's got some unique movies. Him and his brother, for that matter. McDonough also wrote and directed Seven Psychopaths.
That's the other big one, yeah.
2012. His play The Pillow Man was staged not only on Broadway, but also in Iran to a surprisingly warm reception. That was an interesting nugget.
Because it's always hot over there.
Yeah. Okay. The Pillow Man, what does that mean?
Well, you know, warm reception, hot temperatures.
Oh, that you made a temperature joke.
Gonna be a father someday.
Dad jokes. McDonough was an executive producer for two of his brother's movies, The Second Death and The Guard. The Guard, which I do recommend, with starring Brendan Gleeson and Don Cheadle. That's kind of a very McDonough-esque.
What's that one about?
Movie. It's across the pond. FBI agent Don Cheadle goes out there to help small town cop Brendan Gleeson solve some crime. It was kind of cool.
You can tell I've seen it.
Go figure. John Michael McDonough, you know, writes a lot of movies that are kind of like Martin McDonough movies. But John Michael McDonough has had a long career. He's also written Ned Kelly, and he wrote and directed both Calvary and War on Everyone, those two movies premiering in the last 2 years.
Hmm. Impressive.
So the movie Three Billboards stars Frances McDormand. She is one of the few actresses who have ever achieved the triple crown of acting, winning an Oscar for Fargo, an Emmy for Olive Kitteridge, and a Tony for the off-Broadway play Good People.
We got to get her a Grammy. Yeah. We need a.
Can she sing?
Frances McDormand needs the EGOT.
Did she sing in Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day, Michael?
Maybe get her the maybe turn Three Billboards into a book and have her narrate. There you go.
Audio award winner.
Cheap way, yeah.
Does that count now?
I have no idea. That doesn't count. We are on a Grammys podcast.
What's the best podcaster? A potty? We
don't. A potty?
Wow, that's bad. That's terrible.
Yeah, with our arrested development mindset, it might as well be.
I think our grandparents wrote most of these jokes so far in this episode.
We have lost all of our listening audience. Turned us off in disgust.
Anyway, Frances McDormand's mother was a nurse and her father was a Disciples of Christ minister. Her sister is also a minister for the same church. Her parents moved around a lot.
These Hollywood stars are just, they all have the same backgrounds.
Yeah, right. The parents moved around a lot, and her father primarily worked to found and restore these churches, I guess rejuvenate these churches.
You know, if you don't believe in karma and like God or like some higher power, there's a lot of bad people in Hollywood, as this year has shown us, but a lot of these people we find are just from really good people, like decent
good
war
stock.
Veterans,
well,
hero priests, and you know, not the disgusting kind. And
well, that was an all-time great tell-off scene that we'll get to, no question. Culpable. McDormand graduated from Bethany College and then went on to Yale Drama School for her master's, where she was roommates with none other than Holly Hunter.
Oh, how about that?
It's back from our Holly Hunter pod.
We got to have a roommate pod. All these famous roommates that, yeah, we touch on in the past episodes.
You know, McDormand made her feature film debut in 1984's Blood Simple, the same year she married Joel Cohen, who was one of the directors of that film.
Starting off hot, yep.
Yeah, they have one adopted son together. They've been married ever since. Some of my favorite Frances McDormand movies include a lot of Coen Brothers films, Fargo, Burn After Reading. I also loved her in Wonder Boys, Almost Famous, Moonrise Kingdom. She's won one Oscar for Fargo, as I mentioned. She's also been nominated three more times for Mississippi Burning, Almost Famous, and North Country.
Yeah, she's not the type of actress you think of as Hollywood royalty, but she is a thespian.
Capital T.
Mm.
Sam Rockwell is also the next big hitter in the Oscar conversation for Best Supporting Actor, which is a wide open race.
Yeah,
I think
getting to be pretty good too.
It's an abrasive role, as we'll get into. But
what do you think?
To give you a little background on Sam Rockwell, he was raised in San Francisco by his dad and spent summers with his mom in New York City.
Everywhere you look, everywhere.
Born to two actors. His first acting roles came acting with his mother during their during his summer vacation.
Why not?
Plays. He went to an alternative high school, as some do, known to California stoners. But there he does learn to love performance, and he goes to New York after college to pursue acting straight away. His first movie was Clown House, produced by Francis Ford Coppola's production company. From there, he acts in a bunch of small TV roles to support himself, though. I mean, he's doing a lot of grunt work. A busboy, food delivery guy for a burrito restaurant.
There you go.
They emphasized that one, so I guess he had that job for a while.
We probably met him at some point.
Yeah. One of those guys we almost ran over on his bike in New York. I don't worry about, like, cars. I'm going to get in a smash up next time I drive in the city. But I don't worry about cars in New York. It was always the bike. The guys,
the guys on bikes
scared
yeah.
the crap out of me. Yeah. It was like, and that premium rush. I was just like an old man on a, yelling at kids on his lawn whole movie.
I love what,
like,
gives you
stop going
horror
so fast.
Flashbacks is the Joseph Gordon-Levitt bike delivery vehicle.
Premium rush. Stop going so fast. I almost hit you last week. Anyway,
we're dealing with a horribly racist, horribly misogynistic, horribly awful rape movie. No, we're waxing poetic about the dangers of premium rush.
They don't even wear helmets, some of them. And they have their bags sticking out, so if they don't hit, the bag of food is hitting your car.
Tell you what's really wrong with America.
Anyway, burrito restaurant delivery boy and Sam Rockwell even worked as an assistant to a private detective. Tell me that. Now, that's just an actor trying to take a kooky job.
He's just, he was probably researching a role.
Yeah, right.
Unbeknownst to the detective.
His turning point comes with a role in Box of Moonlight. And then his first kind of big break. So Box of Moonlight put him on the indie film radar for everybody. And then his first big break comes with the Stephen King adaptation, The Green Mile.
There you go.
His breakout comedy role came in Galaxy Quest. He's one of my favorite characters in that underrated masterpiece.
Very funny, very underrated.
And I love him in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, the script written by Charlie Kaufman and the movie directed by George Clooney. One of my favorite movies about show business.
Another cult one that got a big following after it came out. It wasn't a big box office hit, but it definitely left an impression.
Yeah, that's a fun watch. Crazy zany movie, but Sam Rockwell really shows his chops in that one for sure. He's been in a relationship with Leslie Bibb since 2007.
Oh, good for him.
Some of my other favorite Sam Rockwell performances are Matchstick Men, Frost Nixon, Moon, which is a very underrated movie.
I have to see that. Everybody always tells me that I would love it.
Son of Bowie.
Yeah, I have to see that.
Son of Bowie before he went to Warcraft route. I wish he would get back to the... some directors you just wish wouldn't go blockbuster so quick. Son of Bowie is one of those. Anyway, Seven Psychopaths, of course. You know, I didn't do biographies for the rest of them, but you got some heavy hitters in this cast of Three Billboards. It also stars Woody Harrelson, John Hawks, Peter Dinklage, Lucas Hedges, Caleb Landry Jones, Abby Cornish, Samara Weaving, Clark Peters, Darrell Britt Gibson, and Zelko Ivanek.
It's amazing what Caleb Landry Jones is able to do playing backup quarterback to Ben Roethlisberger all year. He still has time to make these movies.
Yeah, I totally confused him in the Get Out profile from episode one with with the other guy in that movie. But yeah, I'm a jerk.
It's all right. Well, you know, we that's why we grow as people. That's, if you listen to us every episode, you're going to hear us screw up. And then 18 episodes later, we'll reflect back and fix
eventually
it.
Eventually correct it. I mean, some quick production notes. Principal photography began on May 2nd, 2016, and went for 33 days. And you were saying before, like, the look of this movie makes you feel at home in Missouri.
Yeah, definitely got the small town vibe that at least it was confirmation bias for me that I have.
You're backtracking, but yes, it was filmed in Silva, North Carolina. So as
there you go.
Throw an egg on your face. Okay, Mike, so throw it back over to you for some specs.
Let's do Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which also isn't a real town, that it doesn't exist. written and directed by Martin McDonagh, he with only 7 Psychopaths and In Bruges has directed feature films to his credit, as Mike told us. Both considered to be cult followings, as we said. It's a Fox Searchlight distributor, so if A24 wasn't having the distributor year of all distributors, then Fox Searchlight might be.
Yeah.
Those two were the...
Did Disney buy them? I don't know.
I don't think so. I'm not positive, but, you know, listen to us in 18 episodes and I'll be able to tell you correctly. Currently sits at an 8.5 IMDb rating on 13,000 plus reviews and an 87 Meta rating from Metacritic. Rotten Tomato also has an average of 8.5 out of 10 from 223 critic reviews, certified fresh at 93%, and an audience score of 87%, averaging a 4.2 out of 5 audience rating. Now, 13,000 reviews is a little light for an IMDb picture, but were it to keep that pace, if it were to stay at an 8.5, it would find itself tied for 36th in the IMDb Top 250, along the likes of such films as Back to the Future, The Departed, Alien, and Apocalypse Now, which we all know is the second greatest apocalypse-titled film ever made behind X-Men Apocalypse.
No! A-minus cinema score, too. So, yeah, I mean, the audiences really like this one.
Getting a lot of love.
Audiences on the internet.
Yeah, which is what really matters. $15 million budget for the film, and has raked in $23 million domestically thus far, with no international release. Good for the 85th highest domestic grossing film of the year, which is nice for a little $15 million picture. As far as the award circuit goes, and we'll talk about the big prelude to the Oscars and different critics' award circles, 6 Golden Globe nominations for this movie for original score,
yes.
Supporting actor Sam Rockwell, lead actress in drama Frances McDormand, original screenplay, or I'm sorry, just screenplay, director McDonagh, and best picture drama. It has 4 SAG nominations for supporting actor Woody Harrelson, supporting actor Sam Rockwell, so a little cannibalism there in the same category. Outstanding performance by a cast. And
that usually doesn't go well.
No, we've touched on that. That causes more harm than good and could lead to a Harry and Tonto finish. And best lead actress for McDormand. And 6 Critics' Choice nominees for director, acting ensemble, supporting actor Sam Rockwell. So Rockwell gets all 3 of the big Prelude award show actor nominations. And also nominated for Critics' Choice Original Screenplay, Lead Actress for Frances McDormand, and Best Movie. So, Frances McDormand, big in a lot of the categories. Sam Rockwell, big in a lot of categories. Woody Harrelson, when we first started doing the podcast over the summer, his name was in there a lot. Kind of trailed off, and now it seems to get a little more momentum back.
It's a mixture of other people, you know, stepping up to the candidacy,
more eyes on more movies, and
I think the Rockwell performance has, you know, distinguished itself a little bit, but
I totally agree.
This is Woody Harrelson being Woody Harrelson. I mean, he's great like this often. I mean, this kind of expressions he makes is kind of what you see from him in many movies. So I don't know how much different this performance is.
Right, this is the Emma Stone in La La Land problem I always have. I mean, is Woody Harrelson acting in this, or is he just being Woody Harrelson?
It's criticism that Octavia Spencer is getting a lot of right now.
Yes,
because
yes,
which she's been that.
We talk about in the Our Shape of Water Oscar profile.
She's been similar in a lot of different performances, so I don't know. We'll see. I mean, in terms of the projections for the Oscar, 25 out of 26 experts on Gold Derby. Again, that's a site that we like. Gold Derby experts have 3 billboards up for Best Picture, 25 out of 26. 5 out of 26 have Martin McDonagh up for Best Director, so he's kind of fallen down a little bit. And 25 out of 26 have Frances McDormand up for Best Actress. 14 experts have her at number 1.
So there you go. Like every other expert is picking her to win the category. The film did make AFI's top 10 list. But like Mike just alluded to, there's kind of 3 stories going into the Oscars as far as with this movie. Number 1, will Frances McDormand win her 2nd Oscar since her legendary turn in Fargo 20 years ago in 1997? Mike just gave you the stats about what she has in Gold Derby, and that basically 50% of the critics kind of have her as the winner.
She's got an edge right now. I mean, I think I looked at this last week.
So she's the leader in the clubhouse, probably. Either her or Sally Hawkins are seeing a lot of the best lead actress publicity. Number 2, the chances at Best Picture for the movie. We've talked about the correlation between receiving a Best Picture drama nomination at the Golden Globes and the likelihood of receiving such a nomination at the Oscars. Very high, so especially with 10 nominations at the Oscars now, I don't think anyone would be shocked to see this in there. Probably
it's expected.
Foregone conclusion, yeah. And number 3, like we touched on when I was rambling here, the supporting acting cannibalism between Woody Harrelson and Sam Rockwell. We've seen it time and time again. It hasn't happened so much recently as studios try to position their nominees for different categories for better chances of success. But Will Woody Harrelson's turn affect Sam Rockwell's chances? Will Sam Rockwell's turn affect Woody Harrelson's chances for that supporting actor nomination or win? Who knows?
It's a tough call. You got a lot of great ensembles this year. Call Me By Your Name, Michael Stuhlbarg, as well as Armie Hammer are being looked at. So that's going to, you know, pull people in a lot of different directions. I mean, Shape of Water that we talked about is going to have a bunch of people up for it, even though it as it gets closer to the award show, they're starting to back one horse. I think, you know, the promotional engine from these studios are starting to, you know, campaign for one person.
It definitely feels like Sam Rockwell's performance is the one that they want to.
Yeah, Richard Jenkins.
Yep.
Kind of had the same it was bottled with Stuhlbarg and Shannon for a while there, and Richard Jenkins kind of emerged through that. So we'll see.
So those are the specs in the box office for this movie and where it sits right now critically as far as the awards picture and the Oscars picture goes. What were your expectations going into this movie?
Love Martin McDonagh films, like I said, in Bruges, Seven Psychopaths. They're all nuts.
Yes.
I expected another nutty movie, especially after watching the trailer.
You got it in some ways.
Telling people up. This is much more reserved for Martin McDonagh, which is shocking
to say. In comparison, as far as like outlandish characters,
You know, characters looking for their hands in Spokane.
Right.
That's like his movies, too, I guess. His plays are like his movies. Anyway, so I knew it was going to be kind of messed up, outrageous. The trailers with McDormand kicking high school kids in the crotch and not immediately going to jail for it. That was definitely something that would tell you, beware, this movie is going to touch some nerves. And
yeah, I thought it would be funnier, too. I mean, like, in the previews, especially when Frances McDormand goes so dry and wit, you know.
It's much more of a drama, there's no question. Yeah, it's kind of a dark, dark comedy. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, how about you?
I didn't really have a whole lot of – I wasn't as familiar with McDonagh's work previously. So I knew Woody Harrelson's work. I knew Frances McDormand, obviously, from Fargo. And I knew she was getting all this momentum for an Oscar push. So you figure she's going to be put on a hell of a performance. So that's kind of all I was really expecting. As far as subject matter, I was somewhat – I knew a death was involved. I didn't realize it was so brutal. I didn't know what the billboard said prior. So it was all, I went in pretty much with a clean slate and was able to take it in stride and see what I could see. And I guess for my expectations, if I were to put a value on, I was expecting like a BB plus.
Right.
And it was a good movie.
Yeah. I expected you to talk more. So I think, I think you must have liked it. Because I don't know if we went to Star Wars before or after, but yeah, Mike likes to talk in those movies. He's like the character in the first Scary Movie where everybody, the audience wants to kill him.
Don't go in there! He's waiting for you! Yeah, no, it's a captivating movie, but it's because it's so heavy. You know, the subject matter is so dark and... But we can do some production value stuff?
Yeah, I think we're going to go sound to sight. You know, we do either or. And the soundtrack, this is a mix of folk songs, country, opera, even some traditional Irish melody. Joan Baez, Jim James from the Monsters of Folk, who's also the lead singer in My Morning Jacket, the whitest phrase I've ever said on this podcast.
I think your brother just went nuts hearing them mentioned.
I can't help it, but I have to do a little... I have to do a little story about my brother at a My Morning Jacket concert. Like, I lost him in the middle of the concert. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right. You know, I mean, listen, he's been married 10 years to my current sister-in-law 10 years ago, even though he got married just this year. So it's not like, but, you know, in half, my mind is like, is he dancing with a bunch of girls? So I finally find him in this concert, and it's just him and like 10 giant bearded men dancing. It's like him and the offensive line for the West Virginia Mountaineers just dancing the same way.
Grooving, man.
Pumping their fists. They got one move. So if you want to see bearded men dance, and this is like 10 years ago. This is before, you know, everybody had a beard.
Right.
And no, it became cool to have a beard.
That was what set him on his path
and
to
all
today.
Skinny liberal douches had a beard too. Right. You know, I mean, this is before then. So, yeah, this was... Anyway, just, my morning jacket.
You just got to groove with some more offensive linemen, man.
My morning jacket, where bearded men dance.
Where bearded men dance.
And it's this crazy use of the Monsters of Folk song. It was a super group. Jim James and others in the folk world have formed.
I think as far as the sound goes in this movie, like they do a good job of putting you in that like Midwestern, that central of the country feel. But it's, you know, when you're dealing with stuff like what we had in Get Out, or what we had in Shape of Water, what we had in Dunkirk especially, which we fawn over every time we talk about it kind of went unnoticed for me. I wasn't really blown away by any kind of sound setting and audio with this movie.
Usually I can think about the score and I'll remember it.
Exactly.
I can't do that with
the
this
same
movie.
Way.
The songs, I mean, it's unfortunate because I remember enjoying it.
Yeah.
Thinking about it
right.
the last time I saw it.
It's not to say it's bad at all, but it's just this, like.
Carter Burwell, who first scored Blood Simple with Francis McDormand and the Coen brothers, has scored a bunch of the Coen brothers movies, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Fargo, The Big Lebowski, No Country for Old Men, Burn After Reading, True Grit. He's also scored In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths for Martin McDonagh, and adaptation being John Malkovich for the kind of Charlie Kaufman crew. So he gets, you know, in with some of my favorite filmmakers and scores their movies. Yeah, I mean, Townes Van Zandt, country music star from back when, Amy Annell, Four Tops, English Chamber Orchestra, all these different groups and musicians involved here that are unique, I would say. I mean, Joan Baez. Music plays really well. I love the use of the Jim James song in the middle of that movie, even though it's an effed up scene.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, you're saying all these names, and yet, I'm not going to speak for you, but if you were to play this soundtrack for me right now, I wouldn't be able to pick it out.
I couldn't pick this song out of all the Coen Brothers movies,
so
like you said, yeah.
I think that might be a product of it not leaving, you know, the emphasis wasn't put so much on the soundtrack. It might be a product of, again, I mean, the Hans Zimmer Dunkirk stuff.
Right.
You know, we go crazy over. So when you're in a year against stuff that's that prominent and in your
face.
It's
so much more primal to have a suspense movie soundtrack.
Right.
It leaves a bigger impression on you for sure. Although I will say the Four Tops doo-wop song in this movie when Sam Rockwell's at the bar and his character's starting to change a little bit. Martin McDonagh does a great job with doo-wop songs, like not doo-wop. Doo-wop
Motown.
Is 50s. Motown. Four Tops is Motown. In Seven Psychopaths, First Cut is the Deepest, the original. He does that one. That was a great Motown song back in the day. Not the Sheryl Crow version, the Motown version. The Four Tops song in this one is just great. And if you see this a couple times, you'll really notice it. I have no life. Anyway, yep, so we're moving.
In conclusion.
Well, I got Movie Pass.
Yeah, there you go. That's life.
Which also means I have no life. But anyways, to move from sound to sight, you know, the cinematography, you know, for such an abrasive script, this is a beautifully shot movie. There are some staggering looks at those billboards, small town America, like you said.
Yeah, and that's what I took most. And I said it to you in the before we went on air here, but I've never been to this central Missouri or anywhere in Missouri. All you see is the news from Ferguson and all the awfulness that came out of that earlier this year and stuff like that. So in my mind, you know, when you're dealing with an issue that's such an epicenter for racial issues, such an epicenter for sexist issues, and I having no experience with the real place, you have a picture in your mind. Whether that's right to do or not is debatable, but having seen what Martin McDonagh put on screen was like, oh yeah, that's where this place is. That makes sense. You know, you're able to see these little trinket shops and these little, everyone's kind of knows each other. The police station's right across the street on Main Street from like a sign store. It makes sense to me.
Small town gift shop, huh? That's a business. That's a front.
Yeah.
A front for like a meth dealership.
I did have a problem with that. Yeah. Like it'd be like if my hometown had a gift shop with all stuff with the town splayed across it. Nobody's buying that. Nobody's buying anything from there.
But yeah, in terms of the production design, I would agree. Yeah, I mean, this looks like small town America. The editing, the scene compositions are smart. They really let a lot of these cuts last and to showcase the acting. I thought they did a nice job there. Costumes, Melissa Toth does a terrific job. I just love Frances McDormand's look the whole movie. I love everything about her character in these overalls.
Yep.
Her wardrobe really says everything about her character. The same is true kind of for Sam Rockwell's mom, Mac's mom, and Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
She's great in this, yep.
She's really good at it, and she has a dramatic scene where she pulls it off. I thought she was terrific.
I think it's the first time I've ever seen her speak in full sentences, so credit to her. Because, she's just, when she has a role on Sunny, it's monosyllabic grunts, but they're comedically timed perfectly, and she's great.
She has some funny scenes in this movie, but she also has some chops. Peter Dinklage wearing the suit on a date when Frances McDormand is wearing her overalls.
There are funny movements. I mean, I don't want to say that this movie lacks comedy entirely, but it's so overshadowed, and the money is made in the dramatic scenes,
right.
You know, and it's you kind of forget how there are so many, I don't want to say so many, but there are funny parts that to kind of relieve you. But this movie is a serious, heavy, dark movie about dark subject matter. And to just give you a little background about people who may not have seen it without going into the spoilers yet. Frances McDormand lost her daughter. Her daughter was murdered in a savage way. She has had, it's kind of a status quo around town. Everyone knows it was a tragedy that happened. There's been not really much momentum towards solving her case after a couple months, years?
It's almost a year, almost 2 years, yeah, I think, yeah.
That's what I thought. A couple years have almost passed, so she decides to put a message on these three billboards right outside Ebbing, Missouri on this road that is rarely used anymore because the highway had been built. And she puts a message to the police department about basically why isn't there any momentum towards solving my daughter's case. Calls the police department out, puts it in the public eye, and does everything she can to keep it in the public eye to kind of get the wheels in motion and change the status quo around town.
So three billboards that on a road that nobody uses cost $5,000 a month in Ebbing, Missouri. We're not going to be able to advertise that way, Michael.
So if you'd like to, submit to our Patreon that we haven't made yet,
and by the way, Tommy Wiseau is made of money.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Because if that costs $5,000, oh my god, he must have paid a fortune to have his billboard up for like 6 years.
A lot of bird trinkets
in the heart of California, you know, L.A.
Yeah,
my god. But yes, to get into some performances, I mean,
where the money in this film is made.
Did they live up to your expectations, Mike?
Like I said, it's a good thing to have Frances McDormand back doing Oscar-worthy things. I mean, she was outstanding. You may have the two winners. You may have the best actress in this movie. You may have the best supporting actor in Sam Rockwell.
Right.
I mean, in just my rankings and me thinking about it in the movies I've seen so far, those are the two standout performances for me.
I wonder if this movie touches nerves for some people in the wrong way. I mean, this is obviously a story about people saying and doing bad things. You know, we're going to get into it in spoilers, but they say awful things, they do awful things.
But I would add, as an addendum to that, it's how people react when they're pushed beyond their limits.
Right.
I mean, and that's, you know, are you going to be a good person at the end? Are you going to be the red character and, you know, offer a glass of orange juice to someone that beats you up? Or are you going to be Frances McDormand, who does what she does when she's pushed beyond her limits, you know?
And no, we'll get to those in spoilers. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. We're going to get into the cause and effect, the chain of events, certainly in spoilers, but you've seen some of it on the trailers. An awful wrong has been done to her family, Frances McDormand. Awful wrongs are done to almost each character in this movie, and it is kind of a cycle of terrible things. And you're right. Their reactions are not always the
kosher.
Most Christian even though some are.
And it's funny you say Christian because the idea of there being a deity to pray to and there's someone that controls everything is touched on and punched in the face by Frances McDormand in an early scene.
She has a lot to say about that with the priest. Yep. That's one of the all-time
greatest
tell-offs.
Great monologue.
Yeah, great tell-off scenes. You know, in the books for one of the greatest tell-off scenes, no question about it. You know, Sam Rockwell wins you over as that movie goes along, especially his performance. It's pretty incredible where he gets into... He may be
the worst character of all. Right. You know? I mean, he may be the most reprehensible to begin with.
Well, he goes from being Dewey in the Scary Movie movies, or those are Scream movies? Dewey's in the Scream movies.
Yes.
So Dewey's, oh my God.
It's Captain Doofus in Scary Movie.
Captain Doofus, Doofy. So Dewey is
my ass.
Sam Rockwell, for the first 45 minutes.
And but like an incredibly racist, awful Dewey.
But it's almost, it's crazy because you could see like him trying not to be racist.
No, because he's trying not to be racist.
He knows what he's not supposed to say, and yet people are pissing him off to the level where he can't help his...
And I think that's
like
goes,
a kid... But here's the thing, like, I don't want to just say, like, these are racist people with a, you know, with an eye patch saying bad things. Yeah. This is like, these characters are treated like, oh, kids say the darndest things in that way. That's sort of the way I took it, especially the Sam Rockwell character.
Well, did you also get the impression that the Rockwell character was of lower intelligence than the surrounding people?
It took him an extra year to graduate.
Yeah, like, that's how I read it, too. You know, it's like, I took it that he was... He's not as culturally refined, and it's not an excuse for him acting the way he does.
No, he's a dumbass. Yeah, he's a dumbass.
It's how he, that's how he was raised, and that's how he acts is because of that. Not that it's an excuse, but that's how certain people get to that point.
Yeah, I mean, the supporting cast in this movie is awesome.
Yes.
And Woody Harrelson doing his Woody Harrelson thing. Caleb Landry Jones really breaking out in your mind as the
loved
guy
him
who
in this movie.
Runs the advertising agency. Peter Dinklage is always good, and he does a terrific
job. He needs
job.
To be in everything.
Yeah.
Once Morgan Freeman is done, and once J.K. Simmons is done making movies, we need to just give all those roles to Peter Dinklage.
I thought Ivanick was hysterical, one of the cops.
Yes.
The other bald mm-hmm. cop. He's in a lot of the trailers as well. Frances McDormand, I guess, to end on her performance, she does the loud things well. She does the subtle scenes. You know, she has weird scenes where she's kind of talking to her slippers and talking to herself and talking to a deer. And then she's telling off a priest. She's screaming at the cops.
Yeah, I mean... It's like the polar opposite of what we say in Shape of Water, because Sally Hawkins is being praised and given all this adulation for her performance where she essentially doesn't say a word for 2 hours, and Frances McDormand is the exact opposite, and all she does is run on emotion and outrage and somewhat anger, a lot of anger, but I'll get into that more in the spoiler section as well because I have something to say about that. So it's an interesting dichotomy. I mean, just for me personally, I'm so enraptured with McDormand's performance here versus what Sally Hawkins did in Shape of Water. They're both great performances, clearly. Mm. But if I were a member of the Academy, I think this is where I would lean.
I mean, there's a ton of versatility. There's a similar, even though there's a similar tone, and that's like a paradox to say,
right? But it's a good point. It's well received. Interesting movie, to say the least.
So, yeah, I mean, final thoughts before we get into spoilers. I know we're going to save our best and worst scenes until spoilers. So catch this movie if you haven't yet, and then come back to us for another 15, 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah, let's give it a watch or a don't watch. What do you think?
It is a watch for me. I enjoyed it to a certain degree. Like you said, I'm mixed. Sometimes my brain explodes by what I can't believe they just said.
An 8.5, where it got for the critical reception on Rotten Tomatoes, and an 8.5 on IMDb. Might be a little high for me. I don't know that I would go, you know, I would say it's, you know, my grade kind of reflects that area, actually. So I might be speaking in tongues here, but I don't know that it's that highly revered where it's one of the top 250 movies of all time, I guess I'll say. But it's a really good movie, and I think definitely a watch and definitely worthwhile. And definitely, if viewed through a critical lens, you could definitely, you could absolutely learn something.
It feels like a John Michael McDonough movie and one of the other two Martin McDonough movies combined.
You feel like a John Michael McDonough movie.
Good comeback. No, but Calvary was a very subdued drama, and it was way more drama than comedy. His brother, John Michael, made a bunch of those movies. Made two of those movies in a row with Calvary. And The Guard's kind of more funny. But Ned Kelly, anyway.
Your point is well made, because in Bruges, I think you would say it's a crime comedy, right? Like a chase comedy, and Seven Psychopaths is just funny. So it's a little offbeat in terms of being so serious the way it is, and it was a surprise.
It fits the premise, though. I mean, you're dealing with a grief-stricken mother.
It couldn't be the cycle of violence, right?
So, I mean, come on. It makes sense that this is more drama than comedy.
Yeah, all right. So let's hit that techno dance hall music, and we'll give you 40 seconds of a dance break at work. You can get up, do a little jig, and come on back. We'll do the spoiler section.
Fist pump time.
Let's go. Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint Spoilers!
All right, welcome to the spoiler section. Hope you got your grooves out.
Cried when they all died in the end.
Again, with everybody going claymation this year. No. This is the spoiler section. Three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. If you want to have the non-spoiler reviews part of this Oscar Sprint profile, you have come too far. Go on back before the big break, the big dance number that we had in the middle here. Listen to the first 40 minutes or so of this episode, and we'll give you all the non-spoiler information with box office, specs, production values, everything you need. This is the spoiler section for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and as we always do with these Oscar Sprint Profile spoiler sections, we're going to give you some best scenes and worst scenes, as we don't want to give too much of the plot away previously, so let's talk about the movie in full.
Sometimes we put them in the non-spoiler section. Today, we are full of spoilers for those, but yeah, I mean, how about that post-credit scene where they actually go and kill that bastard, huh?
I couldn't believe that Professor X made a cameo at the end.
Everybody's freaking out the post-credits. No, it ends on a cliffhanger, man. We don't know. It was a crazy ending, but some great scenes along the way. So my best scene, even though I gave a shout-out to the Frances McDormand tells off the pre-scene.
Great scene.
It's culpable. That's a great scene. You know, my favorite scene was the one where Rockwell and then Woody Harrelson are interrogating her in office.
Yeah.
And Rockwell, she gets Rockwell to say racist things,
yep,
even though she's not, you know, she's just trying to get a rise out of Rockwell. And then Woody Harrelson comes in there, and that's a great cat and mouse game between the two of them. You know, she's in there for poking a hole through the dentist's fingernail.
Double talk and
And then, of course, he has that reaction from his cancer. Woody Harrelson has cancer in this movie, and he coughs up blood on her after he takes the upper hand in the argument, which she immediately responds to in this
with care,
empathetic way.
Right.
She's extremely sympathetic. I thought that was...
Which is so important for her character, too, because...
It warmed my heart.
There's a lot of stuff she does in this movie is, like, without foresight, or, I mean, with a lack of care about foresight, and it's selfish, and it's self-aggrandizing, but it's important that she, you know, you show that she gives a shit about people still. Like, she's not this heartless monster that... And that's the problem I had with a lot of these reviews. Everyone says, she's such an angry character. She comes from a place of anger.
Yes.
Everything she does is... Well, yeah, that's true. But it's also that she's, like, hopeless. You know, it comes from a place of not caring anymore, being pushed to the edge, and this is how she responds. But she's still a human, still cares about people. And that's why I love that scene. That's a great pick.
It was the save the cat moment for me of that movie, even though there's others early on where she flips the bug over. That's the clearest in the script save the cat moment. But
that
was a little
on the nose for me.
They tell you you have to get an audience to empathize with your protagonist, you want to have them literally save a cat, or literally flip a beetle bug over, or literally do something.
What about if you eat a cat, like in Shape of Water? We're in the spoiler section, right?
Whoops. No, we probably did that already. Anyway, but yeah, these characters say horrible things in that scene from start to finish, and yet, again, it's subtext what's really going on. Their true feelings for one another is shown underneath the, you know, the tough guy dialogue.
And I don't think the dialogue is, I don't think it's a surprise to see that McDonough can write such tight dialogue, especially after In Bruges, like when you see what he can do with Colin Farrell and Ralph Fiennes in that movie, and they're talking to one another. But to see the writing in the layers it gives the characters is kind of something I didn't expect. And that, you know, you have these, like I said, all these heartless actions, but these are people still, and they show that they're human beings. They react in human ways.
He takes more time to show you the reasons for what they're doing than he does to actually show you what they're doing and the horrible things that they're doing. So, and that's, you know, that's the mark of good storytelling. But yes, as I was saying, and you hit on, you know, the text is a lot of these terrible things and being said in the locker room talk, to use that phrase.
Where'd you get that? That new?
Yeah, in a very pointed
way. You should campaign on that.
But underneath that is what's happening in the story.
Say the word huge.
Huge.
No, I that's a great
scene. Y-O-O-G-E. Huge.
I also like the exposure it gives the audience to Sam Rockwell's character in full. That's kind of your first big flesh out scene with him. You can see his mental process and
people's of color torture.
Yeah, oh
my
is,
god.
How
oh
he
my
is
god.
Exactly. My best scene, I already kind of said it in when I was talking or rudely interrupting Mike's best scene in soliloquy, but it's, you know, the anger issue. If you read a lot of these professional reviews, there was one from BuzzFeed I read, there was one from a couple other sites. I like reading the reviews after I see the movies, but everyone says this is such an angry movie. These are places from anger, and these are characters driven by anger. And Frances McDormand is so angry, but yes, that's true, obviously, because what she does is in part inspired by the anger of the status quo,
right?
And the refusal of momentum to pick up in her daughter's case. But the humanizing effect is there, and also it's not that she's just angry in so much as that's. She doesn't care. Like, she doesn't care anymore about herself. She cares about her daughter's case and finding her daughter's case. And I don't think that's ever better shown
right.
than when the ex-husband shows back up to kind of, he's an ex-cop himself. He's abusive. He's beaten on Frances McDormand in their marriage previously. He shows back up after he hears about the billboards being put up and he wants to kind of tell Frances McDormand's character to take him down. She won't listen. So he goes right into his abusing ways, flips the breakfast table and takes her by the throat and jacks her up against the wall.
Yes.
And you can look in her eyes and she doesn't give a shit. Like, if he were to punch, slap her around right there, she wouldn't care. It wouldn't stop her or deter her at all.
It didn't shock her. So it means it's been done before. And the son realizes that.
Getting
the son
right up
really
there, yeah.
comes up to her aid immediately with the knife. And then the tension relief, thank the gods.
Oh, my God.
With the girlfriend, the 19-year-old girlfriend.
She's the funniest character in this movie.
Yeah.
Because she's just so unwittingly, like, so
doe-eyed. She says the theme of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, she does. That's
anger
true.
Begets more anger.
Yeah.
She didn't so really funny. Say begets. She said begets.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that was the best scene for me. I don't think it's a place from anger. It is an angry movie, but I think it's Frances McDormand. Just it's people pushed beyond their limits.
The psychology of anger. Yeah, I mean, it's about that, no question. Now, as worse scenes go, I did not, even though I liked the construction of the flashback to the daughter, I think that was important. It was necessary. I love the fact that their dialogue encapsulates kind of the whole tone of the script.
You could have gone without seeing the daughter in front of you? Is that where you're going with this? I'm just guessing.
Nope. Right, I could have done that. Without... I could have... I mean, they say awful things to each other. The son uses the C word to the mother, and it's a hysterical joke that all three of them recognize is a gimmick, and the son says it's a gimmick. They all recognize and kind of tip their hat to him in the conversation. Which she does later, just the son and the mother talking to each other, and it's a funny scene. So they say awful things to each other, and they catch it in stride, right? So it's just the way they speak to one another.
Yes.
That's set up in this scene extremely well, followed through with the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's followed through in the end of the scene, and that the fact that she is taking the car out that night. She's not going to let the daughter use the car. The daughter walks to wherever she's going, and she yells on her way out that I hope I get raped.
Right.
And of course, she gets raped and killed. You know, right after
and
that.
Worse than that, that's the last Frances scene. McDormand's character saying, "I hope you do too."
Yeah, I hope you do too. Come on, I mean, it's just a little much for me.
It is heavy. Yeah,
but it's almost too. I don't want to say it's on the nose and it's coincidence, but it's too coincidental. There's no way and that's the reason why you get one flashback, and that's the reason the mother is going to...
Right.
Go on this revenge odyssey.
And that's similar to a problem I had in another with the shape. I know we keep referencing it, but with Shape of Water, is that if you're going to do something, weave it as a theme throughout. Don't have it stand one time, one scene, to just have it as a plot device to move, you know, the story in an emotional way or...
Right. I mean, so again, the tone is consistent. I mean, the writing is well done. The scene works. It moves. But, yeah, I mean, the happenstance is just so
too coincidental.
Connected. It's like an equal sign.
Right.
And this is not an allegory as I was going to mention before. I mean, I don't think it's an allegory. Like, she doesn't represent the women's voting body of the South. I don't think she, she's, you can't paint an equal sign next to Frances
she's
McDormand.
She's not standing for anything other than a vengeful mother that's trying to get
it's
justice
a very
for her.
Specific movie. Right. Yeah. So that was my worst scene. What was your worst scene, Mike?
You actually already said it, but it was the ending. I didn't like the cliffhanger ending.
Perfect transition.
I mean, look, so at the end of the movie, Frances McDormand's character is fed up. Woody Harrelson has committed suicide. His detective character, or his captain character, is now gone, removed from the picture. There's a new captain at the Ebbing Police Department. Frances McDormand has enough. She ends up setting the police department on fire.
Yep.
Before that, she actually calls to make sure it's empty. She calls twice to make sure it's empty. Sam Rockwell's Dixon character can't hear the phone go off. He gets caught in the fire. And again, you see a moment of Frances McDormand showing humanity, feeling aghast that she actually hurt a human being because she just wanted to burn down the police department. The ending, Dixon and McDormand kind of make amends. They decide to go on this trip to Idaho to go track down this man that they're sure is a rapist that lives there in Idaho due to Dixon hearing about his excursions.
All right, so here's the thing. Now, putting some clues together, are we sure he's a rapist?
That's one.
Yeah.
That's one problem I have. If the Dixon character heard more than we as the audience did, then sure, but we don't know if he did or not.
Because there are throwaway lines throughout the movie where the cop, Lucas Hedges, the new police chief, tells Sam Rockwell that this guy has a commanding officer. He was out of the country when the crime was committed. This wasn't him. The DNA that he scrapes off his face in that great scene at the bar doesn't match the DNA of the rapist.
Right.
All right. So we know that this guy wasn't responsible according to the science, you know, stated in the movie. Now, everything that guy says, which again, so coincidental that it's almost ridiculous, goes into the gift shop, that guy, the bad guy, and runs his mouth after the Woody Harrelson commits suicide and gets in her face. Now, is he just a character venting and misdirecting his anger?
Right.
You know, because this, to me, like, this is a cycle, cause and effect of misdirected anger, this whole movie, right?
Yes, it is. But you could also extrapolate that out into, like, are they even going to really kill him? Which they leave it open-ended. I mean, you know, are they really going to go to Idaho and kill this guy? Or is it just cathartic for them to get in the car because they have a lot of anger?
So to me, the catharsis was they recognize the fact that they might be wrong. And it's for the first time, like, they have been full steam ahead. Somebody does something terrible to me, I am going to do something terrible. They really don't hesitate. They throughout the movie, those two characters are on a collision course, right? I mean, she's a protagonist, and Dixon is the largest force of antagonism throughout the movie, if you can't say that the murderer hiding behind the curtain at the end of it is, right?
Right.
So it's Dixon versus her in one way or another, even though that becomes, and ingeniously so, that becomes a hero and a rival plot line, which usually is solved in the first act of the movie, right?
And filled with animosity, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's usually the hero and the rival become allies by, you know, beginning of Act Two, somewhere at very early in Act Two, at least by the central
The crisis. Loki and Thor, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so this is crazy that you have two characters becoming friends, and then two characters' journeys, both of their, I don't want to say... Well, I mean, Dixon's heroic action, right? He takes heroic action. He saves the file from the burning building, gets burned in the process. He apologizes. I mean, he has the biggest arc of them all.
Without question.
He apologizes to Caleb Landry Jones' character. You know, she finally, once she realizes that his heroism happened, like he saved the file, knowing she was the one who Molotov cocktailed the police station, okay? Knowing all that, knowing that he's just going to burn for her, he still saved the file. He still went through with the fact that he's going to get the DNA of this murderer, let himself get his butt kicked. So he martyrs himself.
Yep.
Like different act ways to convey their angle. He martyrs himself to convey his anger for the mother's cause. And obviously guilt is a big factor there.
Yep.
So again, it's a deep dive into the psychology of anger because guilt is driving that because he burned down the billboards.
Right. Now, the open-endedness of that car ride, whether or not they actually do it, I think saves the idea of the car ride to begin with.
But was it enough for you that they just realized they might be wrong? And I don't know if it's enough for either.
I don't think that's something that Frances McDormand character would even... I don't think she gets in the car. because you've seen her care about the lives of people.
Right.
And I understand she has this inherent, you know, disgust for rapists because that's what happened to her daughter. She has this inherent disgust for murderers because that's what happened to her daughter. She's been confronted with this guy already, as you said, in the gift shop. She has disdain for him as it is. But she cares about people still. She cares about lives.
Oh, yes.
You know? And they showed that with her making sure the police station was empty because and her disgust when she saw Dixon ended up burned. You know? And I don't think she would just willingly get in the car to go on a road trip for murder. You know? I mean, I don't... That's not her character. We've just been shown in a couple episodes that's not what she would do. Now, you can say the caveat being, well, this is a bad guy. He's a rapist and that she wants the justice for her daughter, and this is the quickest way of doing that.
She's been, I mean, it's been escalation, right, for the both
yes.
of them. The both of them are escalating in their crimes. I mean, she's committing crime after crime.
But she's also making amends. She makes amends with Dixon. Yeah. She makes amends with her ex at the restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, like she's kind of sewing her life back together in ways.
And murder, she's doing both. That's why this is complex.
And murder would be the opposite. It would be the undoing even more.
Yeah, but in terms of each step escalates her criminal activity. She and the second to last crime she commits is burning down the police station.
Right, so, which I think would be the crescendo because after that it's when she
like
starts
minor assault of the dentist.
Sure, yeah, I'm not totally agree with what you're saying, but I think in my mind the burning of the police station is the end of it.
But
not that
well,
she would,
I mean,
because that's when the forgiveness starts happening.
Well, she realizes in the drive after Sam Rockwell's character said, of course it was you that burned down
right.
the building. And that, which was hysterical to me when I saw it. I love that line.
Okay.
He just laughs like she's going to give him this
who
revelation.
Who the hell else would it have been?
And you think, who the hell else would have been? Whatever he said, that was terrific. And yes, it's open-ended. It ends there and we're all...
I'm glad it was open-ended. I am.
I mean, I'll
it's
be honest. I've been torn because I wanted to see what they would do. I didn't know at the time if it was enough of a climax. And I still don't know.
I don't think it's the climax. I think your climax is the burning of the police station. I think that's where the movie ends generally.
That's your act two climax structurally. I agree with you there. That's what it is. But the climax of the movie and the biggest. I mean, it's kind of a very, you know, it's
because
fable-ish.
Otherwise, what's the climax? What's the climax of the movie? That finding out that that's not the murderer? Finding out that's not the guy that
raped
her daughter?
She's the protagonist, right?
Yeah.
So she realizes she might be wrong, and she finally gets the chance, and she asks him about it. Does she stop the cycle of violence? So after the dinner table where she learns the moral of the movie.
Right.
From obviously the most...
She said baguettes.
Yeah, the weirdest spot possible. The 19-year-old... 19-year-old girlfriend of her
horse assistant.
Yeah. Everything she says
she's
is hysterical.
Great. She is so good.
And yeah, I mean, Frances McDormand figures it out at the end, and then she says, are we sure we're doing the right thing here? Or whatever she says to him. And he goes, like, I don't know.
Yeah,
then,
no, I mean, I get it. I get what you're saying. And
I don't know.
As most times, you're probably right, and I'm probably wrong. But it's, I just think with the work that McDonough laid out in this McDormand character being so humanitarian still, I don't think having a road trip specifically to kill someone.
You're not wrong in the sense that there's a crisis and climax of every act, of every scene, of every movie. So you're not wrong in identifying those other things as crises or climaxes. But I don't know what this, and I, again, the structure of the movie kind of perplexes me. So you might be right in general, but I don't know if that's enough for me. I mean, is it just the epilogue, like you're saying, the resolution? It's definitely the resolution.
It left you lacking.
Well, it's
so
an open-ended resolution.
What would have fulfilled it for you? You wanted to see whether or not they go through with the murder or if they turn the car around?
But you're probably right. That doesn't work.
I would be more disappointed by that, yeah.
If they go there and don't commit the murder and go home, then it's saying something very...
That's why I think it saves it, because I would have been disappointed with either outcome being
right.
shown. So
he probably wrote it that way. He says he always wanted the open-ended ending, so I guess
he definitely delivered.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool to watch protagonist and an antagonist join forces at the end of a movie. That doesn't happen often. Usually,
so it sets the stage for Three Billboards 2 Infinity War.
So the last thing on Sam Rockwell is that... And it connects to the scene. We don't have trust in his detecting abilities. I mean, he's a bad cop.
How can you?
But this dude is, you know, is not proving himself.
And Woody Harrelson's character lays it out in his letter he left for him.
Well, but just because he starts to maybe, you know, follow Woody Harrelson's advice doesn't mean he's doing, you know, good police work.
Yeah, could this have been an aberration of a day where he just happened to do the right things?
I mean, he's just a thug.
Right.
Right. So it's not surprising to me that he's still failing miserably. An interesting thing about the Sam Rockwell character is that he only starts to use some police instincts after he's fired from the police force.
Nice job.
Which was kind of cool. Take 74. And, you know, Woody Harrelson's character is a surrogate father for him. So it's I thought it was an amazing writing job that you have full stories for each one of the principal characters. So you have a full story for Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Frances McDormand, and that's really smartly done.
Now, and that's given a chance to all develop because it is a long movie. I mean, we're talking 2.5 hours.
The crisis climax of the movie might be whether or not they go on the drive together. Because Sam Rockwell's got the gun to his chin, the shotgun to his chin. You wonder if his martyrdom is going to go to the nth degree, go to 11 there, and he's going to blow his brains out like his surrogate father did.
I didn't buy it for a second that he would because of his attachment to his mother.
So I was hoping no, but yes, he gets the right answer from Frances McDormand, and we don't have to wonder if what he'll do there. So maybe that's the crisis of the whole movie. I don't know. It boils down to that.
Maybe us, you know, having an issue struggling with coming up with it is part of the genius of the script, because there's so much laid out here in terms of we barely even talked about Woody Harrelson's storyline.
Great storyline.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, he's the captain of the small town police force. He's this multi-layered character in that he has this wife and kids. He has cancer that everyone knows about.
I love that she kept her Australian accent, by the way.
She is gorgeous too. Oh my God. He's got a wife and kids. He's got cancer. He has this horse farm, and you think, okay, this is a man that we're going to watch slowly deteriorate over time.
Right.
And no, he takes that away from you and takes the decision into his own hands to end his life halfway through the movie, less than halfway through the movie.
But again, Martin McDonagh takes all the time in the world. He writes in all the reasons for Woody Harrelson's character to do that. So he doubles on the cause.
We always say how we tend to have disdain for voiceovers, you know, and this is one where I think it works. It's not a narrator telling you the plot.
It's reading the
It's reading
letter,
the
yeah.
notes that he left behind for his loved ones and his not-so-loved ones.
Yeah, again, taking the time, triple, 10 times the amount of screen time to explain the cause rather than show the effect.
Yeah.
You know, and again, so they're doing something that's wrong and screwed up, but we're really delving into the derivation. We're really delving into the chain, the causal chain there going into it. So is it enough? Like, well, I guess we could bring a full circle. Is it enough that the
I'm just
going to
sit here and
shrug
my shoulders.
Yeah, I mean, the cycle of violence, maybe what?
Yeah, who knows?
I guess we don't know. I mean, that's the way of the world? Is he saying that this might be our world?
All I know is for sure that it's... I don't know what this commentary says about our day and age in 2017, but it's kind of refreshing to see a movie about awful people that lacks a redemptive storyline arc. And we kind of get a redemption in Sam Rockwell, but like you said, we don't know if it'll take. We don't know how conclusive that'll be. We don't get a redemptive storyline in Frances McDormand's character.
Right.
She's just there, not caring, apparently willing to murder someone without much care, or not, who knows.
Right.
But it's just...
The question is or not. Now, I mean, here's the thing. Like, when you get an ambiguous ending, is it important that you come up with a... As a movie watcher, is it important that we come up with a stance on which side they will take or not? Is that something that we should look at as a barometer for how good the movie is? Because there's a Spike Lee. I don't want to tell you which movie it is, but there's one of my favorite movies of all time, Spike Lee movie. I have a clear sense of what I want the character to do at the end of that movie, where he leaves you a climactic decision.
Yeah, but
again,
what type of person are you? Do you need to know what's in Samuel L. Jackson's briefcase in Pulp Fiction, or are you okay seeing a shiny light reflecting off his face and going with the rest of the story?
I think that's
the type of viewer you are, you know? I mean, if you need to have everything laid out for you and you need to see the work fully fleshed out, then yeah, you're going to have a problem with the ending of this movie, I think.
Tell me what I should think, folks.
And that's where we land. What'd you have for a grade for this movie overall?
I had it as a A- after my first watch, a 90. I bumped it down to an 89 B+.
Lost little points, huh? That's
yeah, I mean, it's really one of those cool movies to talk about. It's one of those cool movies to have coffee about. It's really one a cool movie to listen to a podcast about.
Hey.
And hopefully we got you your fix on the, you know, the what ifs and the, you know, what we think and is it important kind of conversations here.
Yeah, this may be the first time we've done this. I had an 89 B+.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so that's pretty high
finishing
for me.
Finishing each other's...
Sonorous Moss.
You can't do it in an obscure sports. I sprung it on you. You said you're gonna make that a gag. Like this is gonna
that's
be a gag.
That's funny.
It's gonna be a
gag. Who knows? It's like Sonorous Moss.
Three people know who Sonorous Moss is, and they're in this room. Good God.
But that's where we stand. And as always, we want to hear from you guys. If you watch Three Billboards, if you got something to say about our non-spoiler section, you have something to say about our spoiler section, if you think we were wrong, tell us. If you think we were right, tell us. Reach out to us any way you can. We are Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter. We are Mike and Oscar @gmail.com. you can reach us there. Let us know what you think. Let us know your thoughts. Fill us in and tell us where you want us to go next, how you're enjoying this Oscar sprint season that we're doing, because we're going to keep pumping these out for as long and as fast as we can until those nominations come at the end of January.
You know, we're going to preview each category before the actual awards, we hope, we think. And this episode is going to do a lot to kind of frame the argument as Frances McDormand's character too mean and awful to win the award. Is it one of those Michael Corleone things, or is her performance undeniably great? You know, a lot of good questions.
We're gonna see. Gonna be interesting. Come Oscar time, a lot of feels very wide open still, including a Best Picture, which this one will.
We're priming you for
no
the race.
Be up for, so
basically, we're talking to contenders. We're giving you the tails of the tape. We're way too many sports analogies here.
You're George Foreman, and I'm.
George Foreman.
All right, guys. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.